All right, Dr. Dinnan, we're back for our 9th episode. Can you believe it?
Do you know most podcasts don't get to 10? So just one more and then we can quit.
So you're saying there's a chance.
we're going to get to 10. Yeah, and then I don't know about after that. But
we don't know what's going to happen. I agree. Well, to those of you who are new listeners here, I want to welcome you to ThoughtWave, where we discuss tips, tricks, and
why are you tricking people? Hold on. Why are we tricking people? I don't like tricking people.
Dr. Dinnan, not those kind of tricks. But we'll get back to that because I have some tricks that I'm not a fan of as it relates to pricing. And that's what this episode's going to be about. So let's get back to that in just a second. But before we do, I want to welcome everyone to ThoughtWave, where we discuss tips, tricks, and hacks for audience builders, entrepreneurs, and people who just want to do things. Okay. So let me tell you about a trick that I do not like. And it's the end of the year. There's lots of pricing, discounting. You never really know what is actually the right price. What has been the historic price? Are you actually getting a discount? And you know what I hate the most? Can you get a guess?
I know what I hate the most.
Tell me.
But this is your rant. So
this is my rant. I'm going to keep ranting.
Keep rant.
I'm going to keep ranting. So my rant is this. I am getting ready to get on a plane on Saturday, okay? And I went and I bought this ticket and I'm looking at what the cheapest tickets are. And then all of the sudden I go and I'm like, I'm going to hop on, you know, whatever the airline was. And I'm getting on there, I'm getting on their website. And lo and behold, the price does not include, you know, being able to pick my own seat. It does not include being able to check a bag, right? I got presents I got to bring to my nieces and nephews. And all of a sudden, what I thought was the lowest price carrier now is probably one of the more expensive ones. And so I was bamboozled from the get-go. And I hate those surprises at the end. It just leaves me with the ick.
And the part is you get to that ending area, you know, you get in there and you start to see all those fees and then you have to recalibrate and then you got to go back to all those other planes and you got to figure out like, wait, which ones of these are telling me, you know, what's the actual comparable price here? So then you got to like click through on each of those to see what it would have been. And you just find yourself going, oh my gosh, I just sucked up, you know, 2 hours of my life trying to save $30, which, you know, when I calculate my hourly rate, like, you know, why did I do? But this is sort of like principle. Like, why can't I just know how much this thing costs? You're right. That certainly would be in my top five of tricks, probably my top one or two. So yeah, that is a trick I'm here to rail against with you. How do we solve this? Why? First of all, why do companies do it? Let's start there. Why? Because there's obviously, they wouldn't do it if it didn't work. So what's going on? What do we think?
Okay. So here's my guess. When we're in the era of when there are huge marketplaces that are trying to help consumers make better buying decisions. So you've got Kayak, you've got Google Flights in this case. You've got Amazon, which is an aggregator of all these little marketplaces. You've got Etsy, which is again, another aggregator of all these marketplaces. And as you know, if you are not the lowest priced thing on there, the amount of traffic you're going to get is going to dive pretty quickly. So what I think ends up happening is one airline figures this out. Hey, I'm going to remove the ability to do all these things that people are used to having. And I am going to only add those things in after they get further in the purchasing flow and into the funnel. And at that point, you've committed so much of your time and energy, you've selected the dates, you've looked at all the flights, you know, you're thinking through what it is that, if you're going to check a bag, if you're not, all this kind of stuff in the process, you've entered in, you know, your known traveler number and all that kind of stuff. And then you get to the bottom of it and you're like, wait a second. I have to pay to not sit in the middle seat back by the bathroom. What? I don't want to do that. And so what ends up happening is one airline does that. Well, now they're getting the majority of the traffic. So what do the other airlines have to do in order to compete? They have to lower their price as much as they can. And how else can they do that? They start pulling out the same hidden fees. So I think that's what's going on across many different dimensions in many different markets because of the advent of these marketplaces.
It's okay. So then the real lesson here is that pricing, this isn't going to be a surprise lesson to anybody, but that pricing is the first filter customers, you know, the majority of customers put on to whether or not they're going to buy something. Is that a fair statement to say?
Absolutely. Right? Because when you're going on to Amazon, let's just look at your own psychology. Like, how are you scrolling through the products when you put in and you're looking for whatever that gift is that you're going to get your kids for the holidays? What are you looking at?
I get annoyed. Oh my gosh, I'm my mother here. I get annoyed. I get, you know, because she, you know, and bless her, she was, you know, raising 5 kids. So she was, you know, she had to pinch pennies, and she was like a couponer, a major couponer, but everything came down to price. And wow. she would drive, you know, 30 minutes out of the way to save, she would drive 5 cents on a gallon of gas. And it never made any sense to me. But anyway, and I get annoyed when the sites filter by kind of best option instead of price option, and then I re-sort so that I'm getting the filter by price, even though I probably shouldn't do that.
But, interesting.
So I'm just as bad as everyone. Okay, so it's understandable that we filter on price. And, you know, the reason we filter on price is because we take this kind of core assumption that, hey, all other things being equal, the thing that will make our decision would be pricing. And I guess if you assume that a flight, right, as well, you know, it's going to get me from point A to point B, then that's the, you know, then like what difference does it make if one, you know, if one flight gives me, you know, 5 inches less of leg room because ultimately whatever I'm going to get to, you know, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, or wherever I'm going, I'm going to get there, and that's fine. So I'd rather just save the money and I can suffer my 5 inches less of leg room. So it tells me that the thing we need to be worrying about as entrepreneurs is we got to give our consumers something else to differentiate on. Like we don't want to make ourselves comparable to something cheaper, because if you make yourself comparable to something cheaper, you've shot yourself in the foot.
I think that's a great point. And I think the other thing is I'm reminded by this story from a mentor of mine that was helping a friend of his sell her jewelry at a local market. And she had priced the jewelry, I don't know, like $5 a piece or $10 a piece or something very low and reasonable. And as people were coming up, they'd look at it and they'd say, and they'd move on. Well, he got this idea and he made a little change on the price tag. And all of a sudden, these pieces of jewelry are flying off the shelves. Now, do you know what he actually ended up doing? Do you know what the change is that he made? He multiplied the price by 10. He added a zero. So instead of being $10, it was $100 per piece. So people are going by and thinking, wow, this jewelry must be really nice and valuable because it's priced so high and it differentiated itself on the price. So there's this other direction that you can go where sometimes that's why there's a luxury market. People will actually attribute the value to that object based on the price that they are seeing in that moment.
Now, okay, so I can certainly buy that.
Nice.
Okay, so I can buy that. I guess I find myself pushing back though. Like if I'm an airline, like I can't just be like, haha, you know, screw all of you. I'm just going to charge $1,000 for the same flight you're charging $28 for, and more people are going to buy. So there's scenarios where that just doesn't work, right? Where does that work? Where does that not work?
Well, I think that works in luxury consumer goods a lot of times. I also think it works in high-end B2B situations as well, where you may need more support, you may need white glove service, you may be paying to have a better experience in the buying process. So I think it can work, especially if you're trying to set yourself out as the luxury version of whatever it is that you are selling within that industry. But you're right, it's not always going to end up being the right strategy for everyone, because there's sometimes there's only markets in which everything is commoditized and there's not a way to really differentiate from the experience. Because I think what you're bringing up in the airline experience is there's actually not a great way to make the experience that much fundamentally different between the two, or between, you know, the various choices that we have. Like, what's the difference between the Delta, the United, the American Airlines, whatever the airline may be? You know, what really truly can they do to differentiate?
I mean, I guess that's where you start getting into, right? So then, you know, I guess it's what, you know, first class and business class traveler, the core. You know, that's where airlines try to make a lot of their money, and that's where they're upticking the charge. And I guess those are, so they're catering to the people who want to be able to have spent a lot more. I guess it's looking at your market and saying, you know, I'm in a market where people want to show what they have. You know, so if I'm carrying a Hermes bag, it's because I'm saying, like, look, I just want you to know that I have an Hermes bag, right? Or if I'm, you know, walking around in a, you know, a Breguet watch, I just want you to know that that's the watch I have. And so the cost is part of the value I'm flaunting as the consumer. Now, there's going to be some consumers who are like, I don't care if you know I got here on Spirit Airlines because I, you know, I still made my trip to, you know, you're going to visit your niece and nephew in New Jersey, right? So you're going to visit your niece and nephew in New Jersey, and, you know, your niece and nephew aren't going to really care if you had taken a private jet or in fact, they're actually going to probably be more interested in if you took the, you know, the big jet with, you know, was it a Frontier, the one with the animal, the cute animal on it. That's going to actually make them happier than, you know, a little private jet. They're like, why is that plane so small if you take a private jet? But I guess there is a world also where, you know, having that private jet does signal certain things, and, you know, and that's worth recognizing too. So, okay. So then where this starts to go to me is, well, the reason I was thinking about tricks was I read an article earlier this week about, I guess, the FTC, they banned, this was on the docket for a while, but I think the ban just went through, I guess, banning junk fees on tickets and hotels, right? So so airlines, they've already kind of stepped in and tried to regulate, and oddly enough, it's just become more chaotic since they did that. Oh my gosh, the government stepped in, tried to regulate something, and it became worse. Wild. And now, oh my gosh, now I sound like my mother too. Now I sound like my father. but then they came in and they regulated hotels, which hadn't been doing this for a while. And so now they're coming in, they're saying, hey, you got to get rid of these junk fees. So I guess, yeah, so let's distinguish what's the difference between a, so you're not, because we're all about being practical here. Like, you know, if you're, our poor audience out there spending their time, they're listening to this, they're giving us your precious time. Thank you for giving us your precious time. What do you need to know, and how can we use this information when we think about our own kind of pricing strategy?
All right. So the first fundamental thing that you need to realize when you're pricing your product, it is both an art and a science. So it's an art in that you have to guess and check. It's up to you as the individual to figure out how you want to price this. And just because something works in one industry actually doesn't mean it's going to work in another industry. And in that way, there is an art to this whole thing. On the other side, it's a science in that there are fundamental principles that underlie pricing strategy that tend to work. Meaning, I know that as a shopper, if I go in and I'm looking for a product and I'm already anchored at a certain price point because the market has been at that price point for a while, we know that I'm going to come in with that level of expectation. So if I'm going to depart from that current pricing strategy, it means that I'm going to have to do something specific, like we were talking about earlier, to differentiate myself. So pricing is both an art and a science, and fundamentally you have to understand that piece first.
Okay. I can buy that. It seems like in my mind, step two then becomes, you know, there's a kind of a psychological component that, you know, that consumer purchasing decision isn't entirely rational. And so if you just try to sit there and crunch the numbers and say, okay, you know, this is how much it costs, this is how much to market, like that's not how to go and price it. You got to kind of take the irrationality of consumers into your logic. You know that pricing really isn't about the number. It's about the kind of the suite of things you put around the number.
Correct. I think that's absolutely true in everything that I see out there when I'm coaching clients and helping them figure out how to price their products, their offerings. Absolutely, there is a psychology behind it. I'll give you a quick story. If I come in and I'm pricing my product and you and I are in a pitch meeting and all of a sudden I'm like, Mr. Dinan, the price is $2,000. What are you going to think? You're going to think, no, that I don't trust this. It's not that valuable. Whatever. I'm going to keep moving. This person doesn't seem confident in the way that they're delivering it. But if I came in and I said, you know, usually Dr. Dinan, it's $5,000, but because you and I have known each other for a long time, I'm going to give you a discount. It's going to be $2,000 for you.
So
that immediately changes the whole feeling that you get. You feel like you're in good hands. You feel like there's confidence here. You're also getting a benefit from knowing me or having a relationship with me. There's these warm and fuzzies that are created around it. And that is so important to realize about the psychology of the other person is very dependent on your psychology. If you're scared and you're nervous when you're pitching price, which a lot of sales reps have, you know, when they're just getting into the industry and they're trying to figure out how they're going to pitch their products, they're nervous. They feel like this price is high to them because they personally wouldn't or couldn't afford it. And they're pitching this thing to somebody else and they're like, it's going to be $1 million. And they get all tied up in themselves, it's not going to go very well. So ultimately, you do have to bring your own psychology and meet the customer psychology and realize how you're both two tuning forks that are going to resonate with one another.
It's a beautiful metaphor. I'm gonna put you on the spot here because there's if I'm listening to this and I hear you talk, instead of just saying, hey, it's 2,000, being a little nervous, you come in and you say, you know what, usually it's 5,000, but for you, I'm going to make it 2,000. What's the difference between that? If you knew it was going to be 2,000, what's the difference between that and the junk fee, the person who's trying to hide? I mean, aren't you manipulating the psychology of using the same kind of way?
Here's my personal belief on this, okay? Like in general, we all have a retail number where we think the product ultimately should be priced. And I am a huge fan of doing people a solid who are in your network because these are the people that you interact with on a day-to-day. And so I like trying to figure out a way to give gifts to my clients, whether that's through a discount or actually whether that's through physical gifts and things like that, because that is the kind of experience that I want to create for them. So even, let's just say, even if the normal price is $2,000, fine, I'll come in and say, I'm going to knock $100 off for you because you're Aaron and I really like you, Aaron, and great. Like, I like using that. I think the psychology of that is really important because people love discounts at the end of the day, right? So why not give people ultimately what they want in that arena?
I guess here's where you could have me is, ultimately we got to sell a product. If you're building a product, you're going to be asking for money. You're going to be trying to sell, whether it's an airline or a SaaS service or whatever, or a consulting business. You're selling to people, and you're right in the sense that if the airline is basically you come away and you feel dirty. You, as you said, you got the ick from the airline. That their tactics made you feel ick. Whereas the tactics you're describing make someone feel like, oh, I got a discount. I feel good about this purchase. I feel like this person cares and it made me happy. Even if we know it's kind of a manipulation of psychology, functionally everything is a manipulation of psychology, right? I mean, even falling in love with someone is a manipulation of psychology. When you're in love, when you're crushing on someone, you feel good, you feel great, you're excited to get up in the morning, you think about it in the shower, whatever it is. And so that's like a good. So, okay, so if you're making someone feel good in the sales process, I could argue that would be the core reason to do it. Like, how do you make your customer feel good about buying from you rather than terrible about buying from you? And that's my problem with airlines is you just feel terrible about buying from them.
That is a very cool perspective, right? So what I hear you saying and the words that I would use for this is like a lot of things are about positioning. So here's how I would might use it for those of our listeners who have kids. I do not have kids, but I have lots of friends and family who do have kids. And you know, there's a lot that you can learn about positioning something when you're working with children, for instance, right?
Yeah, tell me about parenthood, Chris.
Let me give you all my knowledge.
Teach me. Thank you.
You want to know what's funny about this is like an inordinate amount of my social media consumption are like parenting hacks and tips and tricks because I just find kids fascinating and I find the psychology of kids fascinating. So I am no expert, but I find some of these things really interesting. And so one of the things that I have found that I think is super cool is, you know, there's this idea when you're trying to get your kids to go somewhere. Well, they giving people, kids especially, a choice and saying something like, hey, do you want to get in the car by yourself or do you want me to help you get in the car? As opposed to saying, I need you to get in the car right now. And I'm sure there's reasons to do all of these things. But in general, I'd say that like the winning practice is that first one where you're giving them a choice of how they want to get in the car. It's not if they're going to get in the car, they're getting in the car. But do they want your help or are they going to do it by themselves? And there's this positioning I feel like tends to help move those things forward. And so I'd say like we don't ever lose that psychology in us. However, you've got to dress the thing up, make the medicine look like an airplane, sound like an airplane. You've got to sometimes do those things. And that to me is called positioning, right? It helps people helps people see things in a different light. And I think those things are great to consider in the process because it speaks to what you were talking about earlier, where it's like you're creating an experience. How can we make this experience fun, better, more engaging? How can we price something in a way that doesn't give me the ick when I go in and buy it? And if you can figure out a way to do that, do that.
I have to stand up for every parent listening. And I just have to come here and say, it sounds wonderful to go to your kid when you're running. Like, would you like to get in the car yourself? Or would you like help? In the real world, that us parents actually live in, it's more like get in the damn. We are late, and it's always the frustrating. Is like I'm late for your ballet practice, right? Like I'm never late for the thing that I want to go do. I'm always late to get you to your birthday party or your dance practice or your gymnastics lesson or whatever it is, and I find myself going, why am I getting so dang stressed out and yelling at my kid to just get in the damn car for anyway? Sorry. You can tell.
Such a good point. Yeah. Like all these things take so much time, and to be able to do any of this stuff, like you've got to have time. And that's something that I know even with my brother and his wife specifically, they have no time. So to be able to like execute on these types of things in the moment, oh my God, how hard is that? It's like,
it sounds beautiful. But so, and I say that because, hey, we also understand, in the entrepreneurial world that, you're kind of under similar pressures. And so these are wonderful things to philosophize about and try to implement in your practice.
Actually, it's a great point. Like, let's not lose that. Like at entrepreneurs, you've got this baby, you've got this product, you've got this business, and we are oftentimes feeling a whole ton of time pressure to figure things out and get things done. And sometimes we make these decisions in haste, whether it's pricing or positioning or our brand. And we're just like, we got to get it out the door and we got to go. Similar to like what you're talking about with your kids. I'm late for the practice. We're just getting the dang car. We oftentimes find ourselves in that position. And so an interesting question back to you, Dr. Denon, like, you've been living the entrepreneurship life and you've been teaching entrepreneurship for a really long time. How do you balance those, the need to be thorough, the need to be disciplined and make good long-term strategic choices in moments when you're feeling rushed and under the gun from a timing perspective in entrepreneurship?
I just want to point out, I've been doing it for that long. I was just admiring my own reflection in our Zoom here. I'm like, I kind of look a little younger today. I got good lighting. less bags. I got some more sleep last night than usual, so I got less bags under my eyes. I work a lot with my students on this. One of my favorite classes to teach here that kind of gets a lot of publicity is Learning to Fail. And the core of that class is reflection. Like, I have my students do crazy things and fail, but I don't care about the failure or if they're successful or whatever it is. All I care about is, what did you learn from this moment? And I think the same is true in dealing with this kind of scenario of entrepreneur. Yeah, there's always things that have to get done. You're always hurrying and things don't always get done as well as you would like in the moment. The key is reflection, right? It's, let's say you make a framing decision or a pricing decision or a marketing decision or a product decision or whatever decision you make, and you make it hastily and you kind of do the best you can in the scenario you have, but you're just trying to get something done. That's okay, because as you said, that's how we're always operating on our own. There is no ideal scenario. Learn from the outcome. Make sure you learn from the outcomes. What happens is that taking the opportunity to reflect. And by the way, the great thing about reflection is you can be driving your kids to soccer practice and reflecting on, what was the outcome of that, right? So you can be efficient with it, right? You can be, taking your, driving your kids down to Disney World and have a, 8-hour, 8-hour drive down to Disney World, and, your kids are sitting there in the back watching their iPads and you're just the driver and your eyes are glazing over. It's like, okay, think, you can reflect, right? Because that's something you don't need to be sitting at a computer for. You don't need to have your hands free for. Like, you can just use your mind. And so if you're efficient, take those moments to reflect and learn. And if you consistently build this solid practice of reflection into your entrepreneurial career, then what happens is each one of those things you try and experiment with, whether they work out great or they work out terribly, you learn from them and you acquire that knowledge over time. And what certainly happened in my career, and I guarantee it's happened in yours, and I guarantee it's happened in every experienced person's career, is that they got a lot of things wrong. But from all those getting them wrong, they like added them up over time and they figured out the right way and they got better over time. Because again, this is my core mantra in life. And I've said it before on here and I'll keep saying it. Success takes time. Right? The reason success takes time is because you try things and you learn. And then the only thing I'd add here, by the way, that always frustrates that kind of, because it's the end of the semester. So we're doing grades, students, they always want to know their grades rightfully, because that's apparently what school is all about. Learning isn't important anymore. Did you get a 4.0 GPA? It's the only thing that matters. But what's always fascinating to me is if you take points off of a student's assignment, let's say you turned in an essay, Chris. If I take points off your assignment, you always want to know, why did you get points off? And I have to explain every single point, every single detail, give you good comments or feedback. Otherwise, I'm a terrible teacher. But if I give you an essay back and you got an A on it, you got an 100 on it, you will be like, woohoo, I got 100. And you will never stop to wonder like, well, why did I get 100? Why was this good? What do I need to know? And you should be just as demanding of like, hey, what's good? Because, I want to know, like, I did this, did I do something intentional? Did I get accidentally lucky here? Like, what's going on? And so when we talk about reflection, it's not just reflection of, hey, why did this go poorly? It's when things go well too, is remembering that's still where you got to reflect and learn, because the learning is the important thing.
Wow. Yeah. Learning is very important. And I'm just starting to think now about all the times that I've had these successes and you take the successes for granted.
Yes.
And we don't take the time to analyze, like, what actually did I do that made me successful in that moment? And what can I learn about that so that I can redo that over and over again? And one practice that I used to do with my team when I was managing large sales and marketing go-to-market teams is we would, at the end of every quarter, do a what worked and what didn't work, and we'd reflect on that. And that was so helpful. And you know what the funny thing was? Is that, what do you think people were able to think of more, what worked or what didn't work?
Oh, that didn't work, for sure.
Didn't work, right? Because we're so attuned to figuring out what didn't work, what grinded our gears, what made us feel like failures, and where we pay a lot less attention on what people did well and what we could what we could learn from that. And so that list was always much longer. But no matter what, we always did come away. We forced the issue. We said, we got to really focus on what we did well. And we'd have those. And we would say, all right, which of these things are we going to continue doing going into the next quarter? And that allowed us to get incrementally better over time, which was a very powerful way to continue to hit your goals as an entrepreneur.
One of the things we do is we make assumptions when something works, and we're often wrong about like our assumption about why it works, and that creates problems down the road. This, by the way, is why venture capitalists are always really hesitant to invest in a second-time founder who had a first-time success, because those second-time founders, if they had a first, their first company was a success, are almost always terrible. They almost always fail miserably. Huh. And it's because that founder doesn't understand why they were successful. They don't understand why they were successful. And so they make a lot of wrong choices the second time around, whereas you'll find plenty of venture capitalist investors who love investing in failed founders, like who already raised a bunch of money and failed because they're like, oh, that person learned the mistakes. But the ones who were successful, never, ever, ever invest in a second-time founder who was successful the first time, because they don't understand why. I guarantee they don't understand why they were successful.
This makes me think of when the Steve Jobs biography came out, and everybody was reading that, and they were reading all of these horrific things that he would do to his employees and how, maniacal he was in that way. And everybody started to assume the reason that Steve Jobs was so successful is because he was a dick to his employees. And my retort to that was, no, you guys don't understand why he was actually successful. He was successful despite that, not because of that. And if you look at the things that made his work really impactful, is he was so focused on beauty and pushing things as far ahead as possible and being very disciplined and attentive to detail. That's ultimately what helped him be really successful. And I love that idea of him coming to his design team and saying, I want you to make the inside of the phone just as beautiful as the outside of the phone. And there is a focus on craftsmanship that really inspired the ethos of Apple and what they were able to do with all of their devices going forward, but it had nothing to do with him being a dick to his employees.
I never bought an iPhone and was like, you know what? I'm buying this iPhone because the guy who invented this thing was an asshole.
No.
I want to we got a little off topic here and a great tangent, but I wrote a little note to myself because I want to make sure we go back to it. So we came to this idea of, okay, how do you make someone, feel good about buying your product? It's important to make someone feel good about buying your product as opposed to bad about it. And I just wanted to maybe walk away with like, what are some other ways to make people feel good about buying our products?
Okay, let's talk about this. If you want to make somebody feel good about being your product, if you want to make somebody feel good about buying your product, you need to not penalize them for the use of that product.
Ooh, so say more.
One of the things that I oftentimes will go back to my customers with when they're talking about pricing and struggling with pricing is I'll say, hey, whatever you do, make sure that you don't penalize them for using it. And what that means is like, let's think of some of the painful product experiences that we have that we distaste. And one of them that keeps coming up from my clients is HubSpot and how they penalize you for all the contacts. It feels like they're nickel and diming you for every contact that you're putting in there. And to me, that's penalizing people for the use of your product. So in that case, fine, you need to charge higher for people who get more value out of your product. If I were to do that, I like their methodology where they will put certain higher level features behind higher level plans, things like that, because we know that smaller customers are going to want to use and be on this level plan and need these features. Enterprise customers are going to need these bigger or more important or more impactful features.
Yeah.
And so they're going to come in and they're going to pay the higher price for that thing. But if you're going to penalize me and also make me go to my CFO at the end of the day and be like, oh no, somebody on my team uploaded 1 million contacts this quarter, and now it's going to be $10,000 more than you were budgeting for this thing. I'm going to get in trouble for that. And I think that's a big problem. And I think it's a thing that a lot of entrepreneurs get wrong, is they're trying to pull as much value out of this thing and, like, quote, nickel and dime people all the way up to using their product, which allows competitors to come in and simplify things and make it way easier to purchase it and to make it way less painful to purchase it. And so I think that's a big thing that people get wrong.
I can think
when
of
when they're pricing things.
I can think of so many products where, you know, and CRM, it's funny that you mentioned kind of CRM-y things, because I definitely remember purchasing a CRM over another because I was like, oh, with this one, as I keep getting bigger, I'm gonna have to pay more. And this one is just like unlimited contacts. Yeah, you shouldn't pay. That's a great distinction. I would say another thing to make a customer feel good about buying your product is that customers should never feel like someone else is getting a better deal than you. This is where I get really mad with, you know, in Amazon. That's why I'm going to go become a Temu user. It's this thought like, oh, you know, they jacked up their price, so then I could go buy it for Prime Day. And the idea like, oh, you know, someone else is going to get it better if they buy, you know, if I had bought it like 2 days later, I would have gotten a better deal or, you know, just, I feel like everything is just wildly manipulated in the pricing. It's starting to make it really miserable to buy because, you know, and then they've started doing things. Have you noticed where they put like, oh, this is the best price in 4 weeks. And I'm like, I don't want to know that, you know, because I know it makes me feel like, ooh, I should buy now, which is what they're going for. But then there's this other part of me that goes like, wait, the price on this thing has changed that much in 4 weeks. Like, what would it be tomorrow if I waited? And so I hate the idea that other people, you know, are getting something I'm not. So I think that can make consumers feel bad.
And what that principle is that you're talking about that they're using is this idea of urgency. And that's a Cialdini principle from his book, Influence. Yeah. And it's really hard for people to figure out how to drive urgency. And one way that I've seen people do a really good job at this from an urgency and a pricing perspective is you can keep the pricing consistent, but you can add in bonus items or value items on top of that for a limited period of time. So an example might be our service. Let's just say Dr. Denon is always $4,000 a month. Okay, I'm just throwing numbers out there. But if you buy before the end of December, you're going to get a one-on-one Zoom session with Dr. Denon, and you're going to get this new guide that we developed, and you're going to get this access to this library of content that nobody else has access to as these kind of bonus offerings. So you've got the same price. The price actually isn't the thing that's changing. It's what's included with that price is the thing that's changing. So maybe that's a better, more feel-good way of doing this than just saying like, hey, for limited time, like we're discounting it by 20%. Good luck.
It reminds me of the psychology I use for grading my students. I discovered this weird thing. So what I do, this is going to be complex or something, let me simplify it, is I have these weekly assignments in my class where you just have to do them every week, and they're all worth a few points, and they total up to 100 points, you know, total by the end of the semester. But then I actually like to make it because there's one every week, and, you know, and sometimes students don't do it for whatever reason. You know, their dog gets sick, or they're sick, or, you know, they were at a frat party, or whatever it is. I don't care what the reason is. What I didn't want to do is I don't want to have to make individual decisions about whether your excuse is valid and yours isn't, and this is why you get, you know, an extension and you don't. So what I do is I have this blanket policy. I say, okay, nobody can submit it late. If you don't turn it late, you just get zero credit. However, there's actually more points here than necessary in order to get 100, right? So you can skip X number and you can still get the 100 points, right? And so I had done that, but I made each assignment out of, I think it was like 7 points. But what would happen inevitably is if you got, you know, a 5 out of 7, which was Which, you know, if you got 5 out of 7 consistently, you would have still gotten 100 in the class because there was like bonus points built into it. Totally fine. But, you know, students would always get upset with me. And so what I did is I changed the goalpost. I made the assignments 5 out of 5. And then you could earn 2 bonus points on each of them for X or Y thing. And suddenly, no one ever has any problem when they get a 5 out of 5. They never complain when they get a 5 out of 5. But they would always complain when they got a 5 out of 7. Because... to them, they had lost points. And so what you're describing is a, you know, similar thing. You know, if I feel like someone is getting, the same thing I'm getting, but they paid, 20% less, I'm going to be annoyed. But if someone is getting the same thing I'm getting and they also got some bonuses in because they bought it a certain time, I'm like, oh, well, you know, good for them. At least we got the core thing we're both going for here. We paid the same price. And so that's a really thoughtful reframing we can use in pricing. I'm stealing that.
Wow. Yeah, that's super cool. And I think we should also talk more about the science and tactical nature of pricing, because there's a bottoms up and top down approach that you can take, meaning I need to know how much it costs to build my product, to get it out there. And based on that, I can say, well, how much margin do I want to make on top of that? And then I say, okay, if that's the case, if I want to make an 80% margin on top of whatever it is that it costs for me to make this thing, and I get a certain price, then I look at it from top down. What are the similar things that my competitors are doing? What are they charging? Or what's the closest, analog to this? And I look at that price, and then I can say, does that price actually make sense? And I think that's a more scientific way of going about it. And it also, for people who are selling, enterprise software or things like that, and they need to know, like, hey, what's the lowest price that I can give if I really had to make this deal worth it? I think it helps to know the components that go into making it and the margin that you ultimately want to make. But that can also, when you're pricing things that way, that can highlight issues that you actually have in your manufacturing process. And so now you know, like, wow, I can't actually charge this price. The market won't bear it. And that means that I'm going to have to find different manufacturing techniques or cheaper ways to do the things that I need to do in order to price it at the price I need to price it at. So I think that's one scientific way that as you're starting to look through how to price your product, you can use that as a potential way to help you figure out what that price should be.
You say, you say science, and I've heard in my head, I hear myself saying, well, this is the art of it, right? And so, you're using data, and I agree with that. But, fundamentally, what we're talking about here is this is why we say pricing is an art form. No one can come in and tell you here's how to do your pricing. Your pricing is always going to evolve. And, I hate that I'm coming away. I'm about to say something that's empathetic to the airlines. At the end of the day, they're having to compete in a market that, that's requiring this kind of behavior because certain player actors are doing it, and it's a commoditized market, and so they're actually having to play a price. I like to think that the CEO of Delta isn't sitting there saying, I want to nickel and dime every customer and make them feel horrible about their purchase. I think the CEO of Delta is sitting there saying, okay, well, our lunch is getting eaten. And this is apparently how consumers are behaving. And if we don't behave this way, we're not going to have a company anymore. Look no further than Southwest, which is in my mind is the company that kind of always didn't want to nickel and dime you. Hey, your bags fly free. Hey, don't worry about. Hey, we don't have the business class. Don't worry about us. And now they're saying, we've got to do that because we're just more expensive at the sticker price, and because we're more expensive at the sticker price, people aren't buying our product, and that's a problem.
It's a huge problem.
So the market sucks.
That's a huge problem. And for us, one thing that we haven't been able to get to in this conversation that we can save for next time is we've got to also realize that it's hard to price something without knowing also at the same time how it's packaged. And one of the things that you're highlighting from the airline side of things is something that they've been playing with is the packaging, actually. So whereas with Southwest, everything's included, and some of these other airlines, everything's not included, and you literally have to pay for every little thing along the way, which allows them to separate the packaging. So you have each discrete unit, and then you can price each discrete unit however you want to price it. So you know, we should definitely do this in a future conversation, but we should talk also about, hey, what are the best ways to package a product so that you can, you know, help your customers buy it in the best way and also generate the most value for your company that you have?
I'm sold. It's giving the upsell. That is our third how to make someone feel good about buying. You've now listened to this whole episode, and now we've gone to the end, and now you know the bonus you're going to get for listening to the next episode. We're going to talk about packaging.
That's right.
On your next episode of ThoughtWave.
Yeah, especially around the holiday time. Good time to talk about packaging, right? Well, with that, I think we'll wrap it up. Thank you, Dr. Dinnan. This was an awesome exploration of pricing and discounting and all kinds of philosophy as it relates to pricing and entrepreneurship. And for those of you listening to ThoughtWave, please like, subscribe, share. And, you know, as a reminder, this is where we discuss tips, tricks, and hacks.
Good tricks.
For audience builders, entrepreneurs, and people who just want to do things.